Good morning, everyone. I will call to order the Minnesota Court of Appeals hearings for today, July 30th, 2020. We've had technical issues, so if anyone does have a problem, be sure and make a motion or something. If we go off screen, I know one hearing we had to do a roll call to make sure everyone was there. Today's hearing panel consists of myself, Judge Werke as presiding judge, Judge Louise Bjorkman and Judge Tracy Smith are also joining the panel configuration. Judge Smith's name identification has some flaw in it, so she appears as Tracy. However, she is Judge Smith, and if you address her in that fashion, please recall what her title is. Now, with all of that said, I'm going to call the first case for oral argument presentation. That would be Appeals File A19-1854, Aaron Dancor, now known as Aaron Myers, appellant versus Ellie Dancor as respondent. The same rules apply for our video conferences as they do for oral argument at the Court of Appeals. You'll each have 15 minutes to state your case. There will be an additional 5 minutes reserved to appellate counsel for rebuttal if you choose to exercise that. Please state your name and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your statements. And Miranda Johnson is marshaling. You'll see it's in my corner. It's in my left-hand corner. She will have a time clock so that you can keep track of the time. Appellant counsel, you can go ahead when you're ready to proceed.
Thank you. I'm Joel Anderson, representing the appellant, now known as Aaron Myers. The parties were divorced in Indiana and received a decree in March 1st of 2018. In March of 2019, Minnesota recognized and confirmed jurisdiction by registration here in Minnesota, calling for full faith and credit of the Indiana decree terms. The motion was not to change child custody or financial obligations under the decree, but the mother wanted to enforce the terms of the decree that were material to child support and was looking for ways to do it. Although she applied for an order to show cause, the Ramsey County denied that. And this motion did not seek a award of attorney fees under 518.14 under the need-based statute.
The way I understand it, you're seeking the attorney's fees both on the contempt of court motion, which wasn't granted, as well as the conduct of father in this case. Is that right? So we're focusing solely on conduct?
Well, we are focusing on conduct because it gives rise to what we thought was an evidentiary basis for a finding of contempt. After all,
But as I understand it, you're not appealing the contempt, the denial of the contempt determination. You're asking for the attorney's fees within that.
Well, we're asking for relief under, enforcement of the decree, and in the alternative, I should say, contempt, because the lower court made a strained reconstruction of the decree's intent, we believe, under term 6.3 for attorney fees, that there was a threshold for being able to seek contractual or court-ordered based awards of attorney fees, and that was an interpretive matter that the court did address. If we can't
get Mr. Anderson, it seems to me that a hold harmless clause, and especially one in section 6.3, exists to address situations where one of the parties to a contract is sued and has a judgment entered against it, and the other party agreed to essentially step in and hold that person harmless to the extent it was that person's obligation in the first instance. So it's all about liability to a third party, as I read it. Why am I wrong?
If that is the situation, I suppose I could bring action against my client for unpaid attorney fees, and would that not qualify as a third-party action. I don't think that it's fair to read 6.3 as a strictly limiting matter where it provides a threshold for any kind of relief. Hence, that is the reason we also brought this as a contempt motion to bring in that avenue for potential relief. This court, however, doesn't seem to, the lower court did not seem to be overly concerned about the obligations. But let me summarize the obligations very quickly under the decree.
Counsel, I'm sorry, before you go there, Counsel, this is Judge Smith. I just wanted to ask you, are you asserting two bases for error by the district court? One, that it didn't award fees under the conduct-based fees under the statute, and secondly, that it didn't enforce a contract? In other words, did the district court have is this a breach of contract case, or is this a conduct-based attorney's fees case?
It was brought as both, Your Honor, under the amended motion. It was not brought under a order to show cause because the lower court denied that. So we tried to say, okay, under 6.3 law of the case, the decree calls for an award. And if not, then under contempt statute, Minnesota contempt statute, it should consider an award. It was not based brought under financial need under 518.14.
Mr. Anderson, do you contend that anything that respondent did once this proceeding was commenced unreasonably delayed the proceeding?
No, the respondent did bring a motion to fix visitation. It was unopposed, essentially, but almost all of the effort went into pursuit of enforcing the terms of child support under the decree. Had the child support been paid, there would be no lawsuit. There would be no effort that may not even be ended here. As it turns out, the appellant feels the respondent has penalized her. She had nothing to gain by an award of attorney fees.
Unfortunately, dissolution, post-dissolution cases are contentious in many respects. And, you know, this couple at the time agreed to abide by a true-up. And it sounds as if you could determine in the spring of the year, I can't remember when it was, what exactly was owed and how to come about how that's repaid. So isn't there reasonably two interpretations that could be determined in terms of what needed to be paid? And of course, I'm talking specifically about the education expenses, but to me, it seems a muddle of when it's to be paid and how it's to be paid rather than a straightforward Minnesota Child Support Guideline application.
There is two ways to look at it, but I think the appropriate way, Your Honor, is to visit the actual decree's award of attorney fees, or not attorney fees, but child support. There were four types of child support that the decree mentioned under term 3.1, 3.3, 3.4. She was to get weekly support, which she did not get. She was to get interim medical and insurance support, which she paid but did not receive, only 15%, but presumably to go up at the true-up time. The agreed miscellaneous expenses, 15%, is all prior to the true-up, which occurred 15 or 14 months after the obligation began. The interim 15% for child educational expense prior to true-up, again, under 3.4. So all these obligations were ongoing for 14 months, even before the true-up. And that was not one dime had been paid. It wasn't until after the true-up, after the deadline to disclose and propose a true-up, which the respondent failed, after the deadline to pay on the true-up on May 15th, which again, the respondent failed, and the appellant's meeting every obligation and paying for all the fees, all the child support requirements, and it wasn't trivial money. As the court did find, there was over $50,000 of arrearage, and that's after awarding only half of the educational expenses that the appellant had paid, and not considering the amount of money that should have been into the child support calculator or the medical insurance and unreimbursed medical, which the court reserved. She might as well have just denied it.
The way I read the referee's order on the medical expenses, it was based because your client failed to submit any new information about the health insurance she had at her new job and any information necessary to calculate that. Are you saying that the record is incorrect?
The record is correct. The judge's observation of the record is incorrect. There were hundreds and hundreds of documents, and I can point to you exactly where the first one comes out. Child health care expenses, index 15, that was the original motion affidavit. That was exhibit one referred to in that affidavit. Exhibit two was related to the child's agreed miscellaneous care expenses. And exhibit three was related to the child's educational expenses. And then we filed hundreds more documents, including more up-to-date as the case went on. But the court is totally misleading the scenario to say that the appellant wasn't being concerned with the technicalities of the law. In fact, it wasn't even a motion at the time beyond TRUA.
Mr. Anderson, has the mother provided opposing counsel father with information about the present health care premium for the child?
Yes.
Not only a mediation,
but a subsequent motion and the six-month review motion, which is pending and delayed.
Were those documents filed with your motion so that the referee had access to that information? In other words, I'm saying, where in our file on appellate review will I find that information?
You will not find it in the six-month reconsideration motion because that isn't part of the appellate record. Not testimony, because in June was the hearing, and prior to that, there were hundreds of documents filed, and I can't specifically point you to the ones that relate to the ever-changing and ongoing changes, but this The findings of the lower court involve prior to true up, and all those were disclosed completely. What was going to happen after the true up, we didn't know, and it was even before the court whether we were going to change insurance coverage to the father's coverage. That was denied by the court, but prior to the hearing.
Mr. Anderson, can I just ask you this? I know one of the challenges we have is to the district court's decision to reserve an award or division of the expenses of the current health care premiums. And I think you just told us that documentation of the current health care premium has been provided to the district court and is the subject of a six-month review hearing. If that's the case, what relief would this court, what are you asking us to do at this point on the reservation of health insurance?
Minnesota statutes require that there's no relation back to the time when the obligation to apply those health care expenses to the child support calculator, both under Minnesota and Indiana law. Nothing in the judge's order, lower court's order, allowed for relation back. So while this thing is all pending, like I say, she may as well have just denied it, even though the records are there, and even though it is still just the appellant paying the child's medical expenses. There are many more points I think I could elaborate on, but I see time's down to a minute now, so I'll hit a couple of high ones. I recognize that under Minnesota General Rule 119, I have to provide an affidavit to support attorney fee requests. That should be timely, but it would be entirely premature, as the respondent's counsel argues, to have submitted it when this motion was brought, because all these expenses have accrued simply because it is an enduring problem for over a year that the this well-compensated neurosurgeon obligor is delinquent, and he has no excuse about that. He has no excuse, even if he says, oh, but I might object to something at the true-up, which is what happened. But under the decree, that's too little too late. And under the decree, you should have participated when the opportunities to select the schools and everything were offered.
Your time has expired, Mr. Anderson, if you could sum up.
Thank you.
All right, you'll have your 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll turn then to respondent counsel. I'm muted yet too. I'm trying to tell you, you're muted.
My apologies. Good morning, Your Honor. Samantha Gemberling on behalf of the respondent, Ellie Dancor. Your Honors, I would indicate that there's three matters, from my understanding, before the court for consideration: the issue of attorney's fees and costs, the issue of the reservation of the cost of health care, and the issue of the cost of the child's preschool. And I'm going to take those in that order. We do believe that the lower court should be affirmed based upon the court's exercise of their discretion with regard to these issues. First of all, as counsel, I think I heard counsel to have indicated that there was no bad faith conduct or delaying conduct on the part of respondent. So if there is no need-based basis for attorney's fees and no conduct-based basis for attorney's fees pursuant to 518.14, then there's no basis to award attorney's fees. I do understand that counsel is arguing that the party's decree has a hold harmless provision in it at 6.3. I would also point the court to section 6.5 of that decree, which expressly addresses attorney's fees. So my assertion on behalf of respondent would be that if they wanted to do something different about attorney's fees, they would have addressed it in 6.5. And the court's observation that generally indemnification clauses are to address third-party lawsuits and holding the other party harmless from marital obligations is my understanding of how the indemnification clause would be applicable. I don't think it's applicable in this situation. If it were, from a public policy standpoint, obviously obligors and obligees have the ability to bring motions to modify child support as circumstances change, and a utilization of an indemnification clause in the way that counsel suggests would certainly chill people's willingness to bring motions to modify. So I think, the indemnification basis is not an appropriate way to look at this, and the way to look at it is pursuant to the statute, and there's no basis under the statute to award fees. This was a good faith dispute on the issue of the true-up between the parties. The true-up was an Indiana provision, and I think the court did an admirable job enforcing and interpreting that Indiana law. As far as the issue of contempt, counsel points out correctly that there was no basis for an order to show cause. The court does have the discretion to consider the testimony of both parties at the lower court, and my client provided in his affidavit his understanding that when the child was relocated to Minnesota, he gave his agreement to that based upon his understanding that the parties would not further address child support at that point. When he became aware through the service of the motion that mother was requesting child support, he pretty quickly paid the approximately $1,000 that was due for weekly child support. We then had a lengthy process with regard to the true-up, and the court made determinations based upon the evidence submitted. So I think the fact that there was a good faith dispute between the parties also undercuts any request for attorney's fees. So in addition to the substantive no factual basis for an award of attorney's fees, I think there's also a procedural challenge with compliance with Rule 119. The rule requires certain procedural requirements be met to award attorney's fees, and essentially none of those were met in counsel's application to the lower court for attorney's fees. I think the lack of compliance with those requirements in the rule supports the court's determination that an award of attorney's fees was not warranted.
Well, but to the extent that the appellant was asking for fees based on a contract recovery basis, I mean, arguably the statute is not controlling that, would it?
Correct. I think that would be true. So then I think you'd have to look back to the contract of the parties, and that contract says that they would pay their own fees. So I think the only other place that you can go is to the statute in what is now a Minnesota post-dissolution action. And in a typical post-dissolution action, if you were bringing an order for enforcement, an order for modification, an order to show cause, any of those types of orders, you would then seek fees under 518.14, probably on the basis of conduct. But I think that the court's determination that no attorney's fees were warranted is appropriate and should be upheld on appeal. The court had already addressed the issue of the reservation of medical support. And I would just point out that—
Well, let me interrupt you on that. I don't mean to point fingers, but you know, this is a situation where the court determined that there was not present information provided about the mother's cost for health insurance. What was wrong with father just, I mean, presumably it changed when she came to Minnesota, but why couldn't father have simply paid what the Indiana amount was and then everything gets reconciled? I mean, there's a little bit of a tug of war going on here, and it's easy to say, well, mother, you didn't submit anything, therefore you don't get anything and it's reserved. And now we have dad that essentially just disregarded the fact that this child does have health insurance. Premiums do.
And I think, Your Honor, the court at the lower court determined via the true up what was owed under the Indiana child support calculation for medical support. And they calculated that into the true up, which then father paid. So I think father paid those obligations. The issue became once we came to Minnesota post May of 2019. What do we do for child support going forward? And the parties agreed in a hearing in April of 2019 that we would apply Minnesota law. And Minnesota law requires the calculation of child support based upon income, the cost of medical, the current cost of medical, as well as the cost of childcare. So father, anticipating and understanding that Minnesota requirement, put in clearly in the record in his motion submissions, his cost of medical insurance. Mother did not do the same. And so what the court essentially decided is the court ruled in favor of mother's request to keep the child on her local Minnesota insurance. However, they reserved the cost. Now again,
so if counsel, to the extent that that issue is pending in a hearing that has not yet occurred in the district court, is that something that will relate back, assuming that appellant does provide the documentation of what the actual healthcare premiums are?
Not from my under the statute, not from my understanding of the statute, it will not. The appropriate step for counsel, if it had been my client in that circumstance, I would have immediately obtained the health insurance and immediately brought the motion the day I received that order. That would have been the appropriate step to take. All you have to do to cure a reservation is to obtain the date and provide the material to the district court so that they can appropriately calculate the cost of medical support. I am not
aware. That, and I that's what I was alluding to when, yes, if we agree with you that it was mother's easy fix to come forward with that information, but it does just appear to be a gotcha moment because, of course, there's some going on, and now she can't have anything that would be retroactive to a pending motion, at least as far as the health insurance. And that's why I questioned you about the reasonableness of at least paying what the cost of the Indiana premiums were until there was a determination. That's not a question. That was inartful, but that's my point. I mean, couldn't he as easily have tendered what was the go by her old amounts?
Arguably, he could have, Your Honor, but that's not what the statute provides. And part of the challenge in this case was that I agree with counsel that he did submit hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents. But unfortunately, none of those were the documents that were necessary to lead the court to the conclusion that the court needed to have the critical data, which is the cost of health insurance. And as the court can see from the...
But here we have a situation where not only was there evidence of what the premiums had been, $128 a week, but respondent agreed. I mean, the parties agreed that that was the amount. It seems to me that puts it in a different situation. And, you know, boy, in terms of my experience, health premiums don't go down. They usually go up, if anything. Seems to me the district court could have very easily and should have kept in place the current health premiums until appellant came forward with that information.
And I understand the court's perspective on that, and I feel like the court has the discretion to determine on the basis of the record what is the appropriate way to proceed, and I don't think what the court did here is an abuse of discretion. It is an easy cure for the appellant, and respondent did pay in full any obligation or arrearage that was due either under the Indiana true-up as well as under the several months pending in Minnesota. So I think the respondent did put forth, you know, a good faith effort to make payment necessary to be current once we came to the, you know, after the order was issued, he immediately tendered that payment. And so I think, you know, the respondent acted in good faith, I think, in all regards, and I think the court didn't abuse their discretion. The final issue that was before the district court was the issue of non-statutory costs for preschool. And again, I do think that this is an issue that the discretion of the court rests with the discretion of the district court. These are not even costs that are allowed by statute here in Minnesota. So the court was enforcing and interpreting the party's agreement in their Indiana.
I have a question about that because as I read, don't preschool expenses come under section 3.4 of the stipulated dissolution judgment?
Correct.
And that section 3.4 doesn't, maybe I'm missing it. It lacks the language that 3.3 had about parties agreeing to certain expenses. There doesn't seem to be a requirement that they agree to the preschool expenses, but rather just says parties acknowledge that there will be these expenses and they shall pay them based on their respective percentages. So I'm having a hard time squaring the language of section 3.4 with the district court's findings in that regard.
And I think that what the district court did, Your Honor, is, you know, essentially went back to the expectation that parties with the Minnesota equivalent of joint legal custody have a discussion about where the child would be enrolled. And that discussion did occur, and there was agreement on compensation for what would have been the 2019 school year. So I think the court, in considering the matter, looked at what happened in 2018 and felt within the district court's discretion that what occurred did not meet the expectation of the parties. And so I certainly think that there's more than one way to interpret that issue, but the way that the district court interpreted it, I don't believe it to have been an abuse of discretion. There was also the issue, once again, of a lack of appropriate documentation and evidence provided by the mother for the court to be able to make some determination about costs. The court once again found that there wasn't sufficient documentation, and that challenge, you know, obviously the district court, when again, when the district court had the information to make a determination to do the Indiana true-up with medical support, the court did that. When the court had the information to do the analysis of non-statutory costs for preschool for 2019, the court did that. So I think the fact that the court didn't have the necessary information to make the determinations necessary is not an abuse of discretion on the part of the referee in the district court. And for those reasons, we feel that the district court's determination should be affirmed. Unless the court has other questions for me, I would concede the rest of my time.
It appears not. Thank you. Back to you, Master Anderson. You. Just wait for a minute for the time clock to be changed. There you go.
No party brought a motion to change the child's care obligations. Respondent claims she did not agree to a particular preschool, but the record reflects he was asked to participate and he had not objected to the preschool selected. The preschool that was selected for 2018-19 and the preschool selected for 2019-20 session are the same preschool at the same cost and paid entirely both years by the appellant in reliance on term 3.4. She thought she was going to be paid back and she detrimentally relied on 3.4 in the specificity of 3.4. And the court simply cut it in half by saying, okay, we'll accept 1 year and not the other.
Well, the court said that your client again didn't provide documentation of that. What, show us where in the record that was provided.
Oh, it was provided. It was.
I'm talking about the appeal.
And that motion, I said exhibit 2 on index number 15 exhibit 3 related to the educational expenses. That was exhibit 15, March 11, 2019. That was the first time it was provided. Then in all those other hundreds of papers and exhibits, it was elaborated on to a greater degree. In any event, that all came about after. The true-up was pretty much the tail end of this whole thing. For a year, child support was, for 14 months, it was missing entirely, not a dime. And only at mediation, immediately before the June true-up hearing, was it $1,000 paid. That was it. And here we have a neurosurgeon, Obligor, just defying what is clear. From the appellant was relying on from the decree in page 7 under 3.1 that it was the findings of what had happened before the true-up that were to apply to what would be obligations after the true-up, not brand new information on healthcare costs that hadn't even been incurred yet, which is what the court seems to want, the lower court. It doesn't make sense. And the agreement to allow the stipulation that was entered earlier, allowing for the court to disregard Indiana true-up law, was that the motion before the court was going to be determined on Indiana true-up law and the true-up law. And here, she's backsliding on that. That was not the stipulation. The stipulation was that the true-up motion would be under the decree in Indiana law pursuant to Indiana full faith and credit and all the Minnesota statutes related to that under registration. The bottom line is she changed the scope of the hearing. It wasn't about insurance premiums that had yet to be paid after the true-up hearing. It was supposed to relate to the obligations under the true-up hearing. That's what it says. The last two pages of, sentences of section 3.1, and that's what the stipulation was. It was not to abandon Indiana remedies and law before the true-up hearing. I guess my time is gone. Thank you.
Thank you to both attorneys for submitting briefs in support of your client's causes and appearing today on our WebEx hearings. The matters are deemed submitted and a decision will be issued within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.